First case this afternoon is case number 57115, State v. Barron. We have Mr. Burns for the appellant, Ms. Feliciano for the respondent. We have a special class here. Mr. Siegel, would you introduce the class again to the folks in the courtroom?
These are high school students. They're homeschool high school students, juniors and seniors who have been taking the constitutional law class.
What I do in this type of situation, I was the presiding justice of the Northern Panel for a long time, and Justice Gibbons came up with the idea that, you know, we should travel the rural areas and show rural high schools and public officials, et cetera, what we do in the Supreme Court. So what I do in that situation, I usually let the lawyers take a few seconds to tell about the case before we actually start the oral argument. So, Mr. Burns, would you tell a little bit about your case, and then Ms. Feliciano, will you tell a little bit about your side of the case, just briefly, and then we'll get into the actual 15 minutes each of argument.
Certainly. This case is about people's constitutional issues, about jurisdiction and protections under the ex post facto clause, and it's basically a case that a person is alleged to have done a crime, and he wasn't identified until he became a certain age, he was over 21, and the juvenile court couldn't exercise jurisdiction over him. It's just a question of whether or not based on the Constitution, some new legislation, it can be tried as an adult.
Ms. Feliciano, on behalf of the district attorney.
I represent Mr. Barron, and he is the individual accused of the crime. He was 17 at the time that the crime was alleged to have been committed. And so, under the law as it was, he should have been prosecuted in the juvenile court. But because of the new law, the state is seeking to punish him in the adult system, which has much more dire consequences. And so the issue is, as the state said, does this new law apply to allow the state to prosecute this person who committed a crime and who's a juvenile?
I'm going to say that, Ms. Feliciano, you're a public defender, is that correct?
I am.
And Mr. Burns, you're a district attorney, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And the state is the appellant, which means that you prevailed in the lower court, is that correct?
I did.
Okay, so now we know. I just wanted to make sure that I was correct. Mr. Burns, you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
You have 15 minutes, and you want to reserve some time?
May I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Certainly, we'll try to keep an eye on the clock.
And if it would please the court, in adjudicating this appeal, the court is potentially going to be deciding two narrow yet very important questions. The first is going to be, is whether built into the Nevada Constitution's establishment of the district courts, is there a jurisdictional void into which some of the most serious violent felonies can simply vanish based on the perpetrator attaining the age of 21 while they are eluding apprehension or identification? The second question is whether the legislature, in crafting a statute calculated to close that jurisdictional void, would at the same time elect to preserve the same type of jurisdictional void for a smaller, narrower set of perpetrators who have committed the same types of crimes and would be subject to the same kind of penalties. The answer to both of those questions is no. That answer is informed by this court's jurisprudence and similar context, by the persuasive jurisprudence of this court's sister jurisdictions, and also the great weight of this court's constitutional jurisdictional principles and important norms of and maxims of statutory interpretation. I want to very briefly, I know the facts are very well entrenched in the court's mind at this point, but I want to talk about a few of the facts that bring us here and why this appeal arose the way that it did. First is that on January 19, 2005, Gregory Barron, the respondent, is alleged to have used a firearm to kidnap and repeatedly sexually assault the victim in this case. When he did that, he was 17 years old. He would elude apprehension or even identification for over 4.5 years. It was only until July 9th, 2009, that his DNA, which had found its way into the combined index DNA system, had came up as a match to the DNA material removed from the victim. A mere 3 months and 19 days later, the state of Nevada filed charges in the justice court, charging him with these offenses as an adult. Barron's position has always been in the justice court and in the writ proceeding, which brings us here, that no court can exercise jurisdiction over him because at the time that he was concealing his crime and evading identification or apprehension, he attained the age of 21. He contends that at some point the juvenile court exercised jurisdiction over him, and the district court, because the lack of identification led to the divesting of that jurisdiction, the general district court cannot exercise jurisdiction over him. This defense is not new. He's not the first person to ever assert it. It's been asserted for decades in different courts, and every court universally has repudiated it. They've described it derisively as being unreasonable, and they've termed it the home free defense. The Minnesota Supreme Court has even described it as being absurd, unreasonable, and ridiculous. And it, beyond the normative repugnance of letting someone escape prosecution based on their flight and the fact that they arbitrarily attained some age, there is a constitutional principle, an overriding important constitutional principle of jurisdiction that underlies the repudiation of that home free defense. And it's been repudiated by all, by the Minnesota Supreme Court and other Supreme Courts, and that's been the basis. The analysis is very simple. Gregory Barron, the juvenile court never exercised jurisdiction over him. It never had the opportunity to attach its original exclusive jurisdiction to him. The reason is because he was fled. It's not because of some impediment external to him. And the point is that it's NRS 62B.330, which determines when the original and exclusive jurisdiction of the juvenile court attaches to an individual. Now, there are certain requirements that, and this will expose one of the critical flawed legal assumptions of the district court in granting the writ. One of the there are two prerequisites. One of them is that the person qualify under the definition of child under NRS 62A.030. But in addition to that, there must be either an allegation, meaning a petition for delinquency, or an adjudication of the person as delinquent prior to them turning 21 years old. None of those jurisdictional prerequisites were ever met as to Gregory Barron. They weren't met because he was concealing his crime and fleeing. But there's still a case in controversy between the state of Nevada and Gregory Barron. And there's a very strong principle based on Article 6, Section 6. The district court exercises jurisdiction over all cases and controversies. There cannot be a case where a case or controversy, or there's a jurisdictional void created because there isn't legislation codifying certain aspects of Article 6, Section 6. So if he can't be, if the jurisdiction of the juvenile court's never attached to him, then the general district court would have exercised jurisdiction per the Constitution based on that broad grant of jurisdiction. It's impossible for the kind of scenario, the aging out of all jurisdiction, which was the basis for the district court granting Barron's writ petition and the basis for Barron's argument. Now, in convincing the district court that indeed that the juvenile court exercised jurisdiction over him, Barron cites to NRS 62B.3701, which is actually the transfer statute. That's not the statute that defines when the juvenile court's jurisdiction attaches. It's .330. Indeed, .3701 actually incorporates the jurisdictional exclusions and requirements of .330, meaning the person has to be a child and there has to be a petition or an adjudication of a delinquency prior to that person reaching the age of 21. This principle is very well established. It's the Constitution that's constitutive of jurisdiction. It's not statutes. It's incredibly important.
Well, that raises an interesting question, counsel, for me. it would seem, if you carry your constitutional argument to its logical conclusion, that the district court has concurrent jurisdiction with the juvenile court in cases in which the juvenile is charged and delinquency is determined. Does your argument render the juvenile court and 62 unconstitutional?
Well, Your Honor, here's the distinction.
Because the legislature has carved out juvenile court system, did it have a constitutional right to do so?
Well, I think that it was empowered by the Constitution to create some exclusive original jurisdiction, clearly under Article 6, Section 6, Paragraph 2B. So I think that the critical distinction there is that in the scenario you talk about where someone was in the juvenile system that the jurisdiction had attached, meaning at the time they were a child, petition was lodged, and the adjudication was had, that the jurisdiction is already attached. The kind of cases that SB 235 is pointed to, and the kind of case that Gregory Barron's case is, are the cases where jurisdiction doesn't attach, because they're either they're not apprehended or they're not identified until after they turn 21. And based on their flight, their concealment, the juvenile court never has an opportunity to exercise its jurisdiction. In the hypothetical that you pose, Your Honor, I think that it's once the jurisdiction has attached, those rules do, they're being adjudicated as a juvenile, that they're already in the system, and because it is exclusive at that point, and what other remedies happen at that point, that's kind of, it's
but
also...
But doesn't that call into question when jurisdiction is determined? At the time
right.
of the offense or at the time of the charge?
True. And it's implausible that jurisdiction for Gregory Barron would attach at the time that he committed his offense. And I think a good contrast is to look at the juvenile court jurisdiction statute in California. That statute says clearly in the text that the juvenile court's original exclusive jurisdiction, I believe it's section 602, it's not in the briefing, but I can submit it later. It says that the original jurisdiction attaches when an offense, over the offense, when it's committed by someone who is under 18. That's not the statute that Nevada has, and it's also, it's not the statute that many other states, they follow the kind of, the form of .330. It's the same law in Texas, in Wisconsin, in Ohio, Oregon, and Florida. And so, it's, if that was the law, then that would be fine, but it's not. The legislature passed a jurisdictional statute pursuant to its constitutional authority that made a requirement that the person comply or they meet the standard of the definition of child and then the temporal requirement of a filing of a petition or an adjudication.
Counsel, I know you reserve some time, but I would like you to address the ex post facto nature, assuming the court disagreed with your constitutional analysis and found the statute applied.
Absolutely.
Does it have ex post facto effect? It appears as though the district court judge granted the writ more on that basis.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And in answering that question or in responding to my question, Section 3 talks about two things. It says, for the purposes of this section, each of the following acts shall be deemed not to be delinquent act, and the juvenile court does not have jurisdiction over a person. Does the reference not to be a delinquent act cause this to fall within an ex post facto problem?
No, I don't think so, because what you have to look at is the various things that can happen when someone is charged with a petition for delinquency. The ex post facto analysis is an individualized, probabilistic, it's a causal analysis, and you look at the fact that it's termed a delinquent act, it's actually a term for a crime that stays in the juvenile system. But as we know, there are numerous ways that a delinquent act can end up in the adult system. And indeed, in Barron's case, we know that he would have been presumptively certified. We know that by the time any kind of certification hearing would have gone on, he would have been 22 years old. There's absolutely no way a 22-year-old person who has already been in Nevada State Prison can go through the juvenile system. It's not designed for them. They can't be incarcerated based on the nature of these charges. There was no juvenile facility. The dispositional options of the juvenile court would have been incredibly limited. And it's that kind of analysis, the fact that he could have been certified, which shows that it doesn't fit into Calder's Category 3. It's not an increase in punishment. It's certainly not the creation of a new crime. And moreover, there's the fact that juvenile court jurisdiction never attached to him. So he never had a chance for those jurisdictional benefits that he tried so hard to evade for 4.5 years. And if it please the court, I'll just reserve the remaining 3 minutes. Thank you.
Ms. Feliciano.
Thank you. Justices Cherry, Hardesty, and Pickering, counsel for the state. My name is Amy Feliciano, and I represent respondent Gregory Barron. The sole issue in this case is jurisdiction, or lack thereof. The state would have this court believe that prosecutorial jurisdiction is founded in two ways. First, that there is a general constitutional grant of jurisdiction, and second, that Senate Bill 235, enacted October 1st, 2009, which amended NRS 62B330, applies retroactively to Barron and vests jurisdiction over his criminal case in the adult division of the district court. Both arguments lack merit, and I'll address each in turn. The first ground of jurisdiction the state raises on appeal is that there's a general constitutional grant of jurisdiction, such that the district court has jurisdiction over all felony and gross misdemeanor cases. First and foremost, that argument was never raised below, and therefore cannot be raised for the first time on appeal. However, even reaching the merits of the state's argument, it's unavailing. Courts create the constitutional grant of jurisdiction to the courts was merely the Constitution's recognition of the separation of powers doctrine and delegation of the judicial function to the courts. This does not mean that district courts have jurisdiction over all felonies all of the time. The state claims that as a matter of constitutional law, the district courts are never divested of jurisdiction over gross misdemeanor and felony cases. This is patently false. For example, and most importantly, the legislature has carved out statutes of limitations over when a person can be prosecuted for a crime. The legislature has also outlined geographic limitations on where felonies can be heard and infancy limitations on offenders. Now, in making its argument, the state contends Barron has raised an absurd home-free defense. That is not the case. Barron has simply stated the state of the law at the time when his crime was alleged to have been committed. Prior to Senate Bill 235, there was no jurisdiction for this situation, and that was the sole purpose for Senate Bill 235. If the state of the law was that there was a general constitutional grant of jurisdiction, Senate Bill 235 itself would be absurd, as it would have been redundant litigation. The legislative hearings further contradict the state's argument. The state itself was a party to the hearings and knew that this was a gap-closing measure. The legislative history recognized in their meetings that prior to Senate Bill 235, cases were routinely dismissed if the person was not apprehended by the age of 21. And the minutes reflect that the legislative history said that no court had jurisdiction in that type of situation. In this appeal, the state itself has taken a contrary position to that of the case following this argument in the George J. case, where the state conceded that this is gap legislation and said that the purpose of Senate Bill 235 was to allow for the prosecution of serious juvenile offenders who were otherwise subject to liability for their offenses, but for the procedural gap. Next, to the thrust of the state's argument that Senate Bill 235 applies retroactively to vest the district court with jurisdiction. This court could stop its analysis right here, because the law is clear that Senate Bill 235 cannot be applied retroactively. A fundamental principle of criminal law is that the law that applies is the law in effect at the time when the crime was committed. The state of the law is toward prospective application of statutes, and retroactive application is heavily disfavored. It would be a grave departure from this court's jurisprudence to conclude that retroactivity exists here. The state has argued that the plain language of Senate Bill 235 requires retroactive application, and that it would be impossible to read Senate Bill 235's plain language as not applying retroactively. In fact, it is entirely impossible to apply that only to those crimes that fall within its dictates after its enactment. No legislative history is frustrated by applying the law prospectively.
Ms. Feliciano, what about the argument that statutes that determine jurisdiction, however, are assessed as of the time of the charge rather than the offense? And in this case, the charge occurred on October 28th.
That argument is directly contrary to the state of the law. The actual law says, and the case law says, that the law that applies is the law that was in effect at the time that the crime was committed. This court has numerous times upheld that application when it disfavored a defendant, in cases like Castillo, where a defendant was trying to benefit from a newly enacted sentencing law. And this court said no. The law that applies is the law in effect at the time that the crime was committed. Further, under that logic, the state, in all cases, could wait to charge a juvenile with a crime until after the juvenile reached the age of majority to then therefore benefit from the juvenile being prosecuted in the adult system, saying that, well, jurisdiction vests at the time we file our complaint. It would arbitrarily give the state the ability to prosecute a person in whichever way it benefited. The state has also glossed over the longstanding presumption that statutes apply prospectively only unless the legislative intent clearly, strongly, and imperatively expresses retroactivity. And as this court said in the McKellar case, prospective application advances the legislature's intent, despite the resulting preclusion of recovery for time-barred claims. The legislature is charged with knowledge of the principles of statutory construction and retroactivity. And when the legislature intends for a statute to be retroactive, it says so. A prime example is the sex offender registration statute passed in 2007 that was recently at issue in the case of the ACLU versus Cortez Masto. There, the legislature very clearly said in the plain language of that statute that it applied retroactively. Now, the state has cited to the divorce case of the state versus district court as supporting its retroactivity argument. That 1931 divorce case is vastly distinguishable. This court very recently, in the 2008 case of State versus Second District Court, which was a murder case involving the retroactive application of the deadly weapon enhancement, said that unless the legislature clearly expresses its intent to apply a law retroactively, this court reaffirmed that the Nevada law requires that the application of the law in effect at the time of the crime is the one that applies, and that this result coheres with the legislature's overall criminal statutory scheme, which has consistently favored this rule. Thus, it is Nevada's criminal statutory scheme that favors prospective application. Further, with regard to the divorce case, the case is from 1931. This court has a well-developed body of retroactivity law, and the law has not been to expand retroactivity, but merely to narrow it. This court, the majority of the time, concludes that legislative intent can be satisfied by prospective application. Similar to the McKellar case, if SB 235 applies retroactively, it would allow for the revival of a time-barred prosecution. The state has argued that public policy favors retroactivity. Now, contrarily to itself, in the case of State versus Second District Court, the state said that retroactive application of criminal statutes violates public policy considerations. The state can't have it both ways. It can't say when it suits it that retroactivity does not apply, but when retroactivity does not suit it, that retroactivity applies. Furthermore, the legislative history of Senate Bill 235 noted this concern about public policy and said that this legislation struck a balance between the state's concern with prosecution and the defendant's rights. The state has relied on the case of Castillo. Castillo actually supports Barron's position. Castillo discusses public policy and says, this court said, the rule that penalty parameters for an offense are fixed as of the date of the commission of the offense is fair, logical, and easy to apply. Neither the state nor a defendant may maneuver a sentencing date to take advantage of or avoid a change in a statute. Additionally, in Castillo, this court noted that just as in Senate Bill 235, the legislature knew about similar cases, discussed them, but did not mention retroactivity. This court found that fact critical to the retroactivity analysis. The United States Supreme Court, in the case of Stogner, has also discussed public policy and noted that public policy favors precluding the state from reviving time-barred prosecution, and that the criminal defendant's important constitutional rights trump the state's interest in retroactivity. even if this court were to conclude that SB 235 applies retroactively, it would amount to an impermissible ex post facto violation. The prohibition against ex post facto legislation is fundamental to our criminal jurisprudence. It protects against arbitrary and oppressive government. The ex post facto clause prohibits laws with certain retroactive effects. The seminal test is Calder versus Bull. The state has discussed category three. At issue here are categories two, three, and four. The SB 235 violates all three, although only one violation would be necessary. As to category two, that category precludes laws that inflict punishment where a party was not previously liable. That has been described as prohibiting the revival of time-barred prosecution, including retroactive application of statutes that expand statutes of limitations. SB 235 fits squarely within this category, as it inflicts a punishment on Barron he was not previously subjected to and allows for the revival of a time-barred prosecution. As to the third category, this prohibits laws that change or inflict a greater punishment, thereby affecting substantial personal rights. This is what the district court relied on. In addition to, the district court also first stated that the law did not apply retroactively in its decision. As to the third category, the state says that SB 235 is merely procedural, number one, and number two, does not result in more than a speculative, attenuated way of winning certification. SB 235 is not merely procedural. This court has long discussed the difference between the juvenile system and the very dire consequences of the adult system. Regarding the speculative nature.
So you attach consequences to the language in the statute that I asked your colleague about.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, if you could refresh me on that.
The statute talks about addressing a juvenile act and jurisdiction.
The juvenile act and jurisdiction. Well, absolutely. If an act that was at the time committed would have been a delinquent act, and then through this app, the application of this law is removed from any possibility of being a delinquent act and instead moves forward in the adult system, yes, there are absolutely increased penalties and new punishments.
What's your response to the argument of counsel that these crimes would have been presumptively certified?
First and foremost, presumptive certification was held unconstitutional in the In re William M. case. Second of all, the counsel for the state says that it is speculative. This court has addressed an argument by the state, the exact argument by the state before, and held that it is based on unsound and flawed logic. In the case of Miller versus Ignacio, which was a case about life without the possibility of parole and the taking away of the pardon's board ability to commute the sentence, the state argued again that it was no more for Miller than a speculative, attenuative chance at pardons. And this court said the state misinterpreted the law with regard to the speculative chance. Miller was not required to prove he would personally have had his sentence commuted but for the operation. And that's because the United States Supreme Court in Weaver versus Graham recognized the inquiry looks to the challenged provision, not to the offender. This court stated that you look not to the person's punishment, but whether the new law affects the measure of punishment of anyone at whom it is directed. Regarding the speculative argument, this court said the state was wrong. An emphasis of that fact missed the proper focus of the inquiry. The state had confused the standing doctrine, which requires a harm, with the ex post facto analysis, which looks solely at the impact of the law without regard to the person who is challenging it. As to the fourth category of Calder, this precludes laws that alter the rules of evidence. Just as in Stoger, which dealt with the statutes of limitations, there is a legislative judgment that after a certain amount of time, no quantum of evidence is sufficient to convict. Here, SB 235, if applied retroactively, would allow for the same vagrancy of evidence.
But I have a problem with the Castillo case and much of your argument, because Castillo would have applied to him even if SB 235 had not been passed.
The Castillo case is distinguishable because in the Castillo case, he was identified
and the charge was filed, and he then fled the jurisdiction, thereby tolling and
But the cases that Castillo relies on are factually very close to Mr. Barron's situation, are they not? And we quote from them extensively and approvingly in rejecting the idea that simply not being identified and charged, that in and of itself doesn't give him a home free, using the vernacular of that case.
I don't recall any cases where the person was not identified until well after the statute would not have operated to grant jurisdiction. Everything that I recall is that the person had been identified and had actually fled. I believe in Castillo he fled before his sentencing. He was subject to the jurisdiction. If that were the case, then SB 235 would not have been required. It has been recognized that it was a gap-closing measure. This case is factually very distinguishable and unique in that he was not identified or apprehended until well after he was 21 years old and subject to. And so it's distinguishable from any line of authority that talks about the fleeing or misapprehension.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Rebuttal, Mr. Burns.
Well, I'll start where the court left off. First is that Castillo's analysis and its reliance on these other cases, I think it's immaterial whether or not a petition was actually filed and then the person fled. But indeed, there is a case that's exactly on all four corners of the page with Barron. It's Elliott versus District Court, the Montana Supreme Court's decision, in which that defendant, he committed a murder at the age of 15 and a half, was never identified. There was no petition filed in juvenile court, and he was only identified once he was being interrogated at the age of 22 in relation to an unrelated crime, and he confessed that he committed the murder. That case...
Murder cases go automatically to the District Court in Nevada, is that correct?
My understanding is yes, Your Honor.
You don't have to certify. No certification, no jurisdiction in the juvenile court for murder cases.
That's my understanding of yes. But I don't know if that distinguishes the constitutional analysis that was undertaken in Elliott. I mean, it's the fact that it's immaterial whether there was some kind of petition filed first. It's the jurisdictional constitutional question. And as long as someone... The key fact is that someone evades, they flee or they conceal. There's no material distinction between those two things. And they flee for the purposes, or not necessarily for the purpose of, but the effect of their flight and concealment is the divestiture of the juvenile court's ability to act on them.
Well, how do you answer your colleague's argument that then 235 was wholly unnecessary if indeed that gap didn't really exist?
I think SB 235 was actually incredibly important work. Because it'd be a bad thing if the juvenile subcommittee showed up, read these cases, and said, well, there's this constitutional prophylaxis. We don't need to provide any rules for implementing, making understandable, practical ways for this broad grant of jurisdiction to be applied by the courts and the practitioners that deal with dozens of cases each day. So it's the fact that SB 235 is absolutely necessary. But its passage doesn't logically mean that there isn't this constitutional prophylaxis, this backstop that prevents cases from just simply vanishing into the air, as Barron would had the district court determine. And if there are any other questions, feel free to interrupt me. I just wanted to address briefly the ex post facto analysis. Barron can't fit into Calder's Category 3. I'll rely on my brief for the response to the statute of limitations analysis and Stoner in those cases. But Barron can't argue that he suffered any increased punishment because he never put himself in a position where the juvenile court's jurisdiction could have attached. He never was in a position where he would have enjoyed those benefits. Thus, there could never have been an increase in punishment by treating his crime as an adult crime. And particularly in the case where it's not anything external, it's no external reason why the juvenile court's jurisdiction couldn't have attached and why he didn't enjoy those benefits. It's his own actions. And thus, that can't be the type of analysis. Moreover, I think it's very clear that you can't just speculate. You have to look. It's not just a standing analysis. You have to look at how it impacts on the individual. And if it is a standing analysis, then we have no case in controversy here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel for their arguments in this matter and their briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.